This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The upcoming Grammy Awards have got us thinking about music. So we're going to hear today from two icons in their respective parts of the musical universe. Later, we'll have the rapper Chuck D in conversation with our own Kelafasane. But first, a pioneer in the genre known as Americana. Now, you couldn't write the history of American music without a solid chapter on Bonnie Raitt. Her body of work is this gorgeous melange of rock, R&B, blues, folk, and country. And she's a hell of a slide guitarist to boot. Rather than resting on her laurels after 50 years in music, Bonnie Raitt is still productive, still making records, and she's never strayed very far from the mainstream of pop music. So, Bonnie, I have to begin by congratulating you on all these Grammy nominations. 4 Grammy nominations, Best Americana Album, Best Americana Performance, Best American Roots Song, and Song of the Year. That's pretty amazing.
I was pretty surprised, so thank you so much. I'm chuffed, as they say in England, yeah.
Bonnie is nominated alongside some of the biggest stars in pop music today, and I wanted to get her take on their music. And we started with Adele.
Okay.
There ain't no gold in this river that I've been washing my hands in forever. I know there is hope in these waters.
Oh.
Get
out of here.
Swim when I am drowning in
this. Oh my gosh.
What do you think, Bonnie?
From the first time I heard it, I was just shaking my head, you know, lump in my throat, go get it, girl, because she just when I first heard her, when Out of the Box, her first hit, I've resonated with her, but this was, you know, you always wonder what's going to happen the next record, and this song is, it's a classic. It's one of the best songs I've ever heard, and her vocal just broke my heart.
The next is Lizzo, About Damn Time.
Yay.
Turn up the music, turn down the lights. I've got a feeling I'm gonna be all right. Okay. All right. It's about damn time. Turn up the music.
Oh.
We're on Zoom, and I can see you dancing in your chair.
Oh, man. First of all, I love her so much. I mean, I don't know if you got to see the People's Choice Awards when she took her time accepting her Entertainer of the Year or whatever, and honored 17 activists of all kinds of different backgrounds and causes. I'm so floored, but not to get off the topic. You know, this harkens back to an era that I come up when we could still go to clubs and dance around, you know. So for me, it's a fantastic retro neo-soul relentlessly grooving. I mean, she's got a great vocal. It's a great track. It's right up there.
And now we have some of you may have heard of, I'm not absolutely sure, Beyoncé's Break My Soul. Bonnie, Beyoncé has been a phenomenon for a very long time now. What do you think of her?
Huge fan. She's a, can I say badass?
You can.
I mean, for someone so gorgeous and so classy and the way that she runs her career and handles the press and handles her fame and is so vulnerable and open and yet such a leader.
Your paths ever cross?
I think I waved to her at the backstage on the Grammys on the way, and I got to give Adele her Grammy, and she, you know, she was so excited to not to see me, but I'm just saying I was excited to be able to give it to her. But I would love to sit down and get to know those two, and Lizzo too. I'm a big fan.
Bonnie, I'm sure you're more than aware, maybe painfully aware, of how the different ways that musical careers start now. I mean, some of them start and burst first on TikTok and social media. Just to get started on your own career, when you watch that happen, does it feel incredibly alien? How would you describe your emergence in 1971 when your first album debuted? I know you came from a musical family, obviously.
Yeah, but the Broadway music scene that I came out, you know, my folks were in, it was so different than the folk music that I fell in love with. I was not expecting to do this for a living. I had other plans. I was a sophomore in college and happened to be hanging out with a bunch of older blues people that I was so lucky to be introduced to by Dick Waterman, who rediscovered Sun House and managed Mississippi Fred McDowell. So for me, it was just a hobby turned into an absolute passion and an opportunity to open for a couple of those bands and clubs and, you know, make a little pin money on the side. So for me to get offered a record deal at 21, when I wasn't even expecting to have a career in music, is such an anomaly compared to what most people do that really slog away and are planning to be musicians since the time they're 13 or 14. They can't wait to get out there and make records. So I don't want to say it fell in my lap, but I think of the people I know in the business, I got the greatest opportune, right place at the right time by being a woman blues guitar player right in that particular time.
You were at Harvard. You were a kid. And were you studying hard or not so much?
I loved school. I always have. I don't know why, but I'm not always good at math and science. But I was very excited to be majoring in African studies and studying modern theater. And I was a social relations major, which was psychology, anthropology, and sociology. So right in the hotbed of anti-war movement and the feminist movement.
What did you think your life was going to be when you were 18, 19 years old?
I wanted to work for the American Friends Service Committee, where my uncle had been involved with that organization. My folks converted to being Quaker and very much into the peace and justice movements. And the AFSC had branches all around the world and kind of undoing some of the damage that colonialism had done, I thought. And it was kind of a more less government-oriented Peace Corps type thing. And that was my plan.
And you were hanging out in the Cambridge club scene?
I was a student, and then my friend Jack Viertel, who actually runs Jujemsen Theaters and became a producer on Broadway, he called up, and we were blues hounds, just absolute fanatics. And we were listening to the Harvard radio station blues show, and Sun House, the father of Delta Blues, was being interviewed and was going to do a concert. And So Jack called me at my dorm and said, I know where the manager lives right around the corner from Mass Ave, and I think we could go meet Sun House. And that's when it all started for me.
I went down to the station. I said, I leaned up against the door.
I was too young to hang out in clubs. You know, you couldn't drink until you're 21.
Well, I want to know everything about your meeting with Sun House. That's an amazing thing.
Well, it wasn't because we were just fans. You know, I think I was a freshman. Yeah, I was a freshman at that point, and I don't know how we got to be friends through the disc jockey that did the interview, and we met Dick Waterman and Sun House. I mean, I was trembling because at that point, you know, Robert Johnson's records had been reissued in the mid '60s, and everybody was just the Newport Folk Festivals had rediscovered, broadcast and on labels and recorded all these great Delta blues people from every different region. So Sun was the pinnacle to me. So I don't know if he remembers meeting me, but I later got to be friends with him.
He said, if you're going anywhere now, son, you know you got to lay your money down.
I remember when I was a kid, there was a record from Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, a great, great blues duo. And one of their funnier songs was White Boy Lost in the Blues.
You bought your six-string Gibson. You bought your great big Al. You cried and sang like muddy water. Can play like lightning sound. But since I blowed my heart, you feeling mean and confused. It got you chained to your air bomb. You just a white boy lost in the blue.
How amenable were older black musicians to a young white woman wanting to be, not just being a fan of the music, but wanting to be a part of that scene, wanting to learn that music?
It didn't occur to me to ask Muddy or any of those guys what those interviewers are always asking them, what do you think about Mike Bloomfield and Eric Clapton, you know? Mm-hmm. I just know that from my experience, the people I knew, John Lee Hooker and Fred McDowell and Big Boy Arthur Crudup and Big Mama Thornton, they were thrilled to get the accolades and the acknowledgement and the recognition and get paid and have this incredible bloom in their midlife of the resurgence of blast-off appreciation in the mainstream culture. And I think the fact that we were those of us that just happened to study from records and learn how to play. You know, when I first played for Fred McDowell, I played some Robert Johnson for him, Tommy Johnson, and I played some of his songs. He was tickled, you know. He said, how did you learn that? I said, man, I just listened to records and taught myself. And then, you know, I know that Muddy and BB loved to listen to Eric Clapton. I mean, they loved Paul Butterfield. They loved anybody that honored their music and who was good at it, you know, probably mediocre, not so thrilled about. But the question of white people versus black and age versus youth and which sex you were never came up in my world.
You know, I went to do a couple of years ago in Chicago, right before the pandemic, a profile of Buddy Guy. And he was, as you describe, really vocal in expressing his affection for, in particular, you know, Jeff Beck, Eric Clapton, your own good self. And at the same time, there was a sense that in him, although it was more subtly expressed, that he had been hard done by, that it was not easy. And writing about the Staples, I remember Pop Staples was offered $500 to be the opening act by the Rolling Stones, and an offer that he turned down. Were things better by the time you came along just a little bit later in that regard?
From what I understand, the prices of a lot of the legendary groups like Albert Collins or Albert King and even BB, people that were bigger stars, pittance compared to the white artists that did the same kind of music. And one of the things that made me so proud to work with Dick Waterman for 15 years as my booking agent in my office was that he put a lot of the blues artists under one agency and did collective bargaining, as opposed to clubs that would say, why should I pay $800 for Sunhouse when I can get Booker White for $500? So it was just a lot. No, it was the same old thing that is the music business, unfair wages. And you know, when we started the Rhythm and Blues Foundation, Howell Beagle brought to my attention that after all these years, half the people on my record collection had never gotten any royalties. And that was blown out of the water. And from the time I started, white artists, especially with good legal representation, you know, the record label deals that we were making were a lot more fair. And everybody before that really got ripped off. And they continued to get not paid for decades.
Bonnie, tell me about the club life that was such a big part of your career early on.
Oh, well, you know, there's a romance to the club life, just like there was with Hemingway and John Cheever and everybody thinking that they had to drink. I mean, people drank and smoked cigarettes in the 50s, and the Beats were the coolest. And then after the Beats, it was the folk musicians and Bob Dylan and, you know, the folk world. So people drinking and smoking pot, what just sort of came with the era that we were in. You know, in the 70s, cocaine was more around as well. And it was just part of the scene. I mean, the Stones are super cool, and guess who did drugs, you know? It was like modeled. The people that were our heroes culturally in the 60s, I mean, because they added drugs to the picture, that was our world, you know, mixing drugs and alcohol, whereas my folks didn't drink, but their world of the Rat Pack and all of that was more cigarettes and drinking. So the jazz and blues scene was way too much drinking, you know, I think. So
what was the breakthrough moment for you when you were 37?
You know, after the things you can do when you're, I never drank to like pass out, you know, after on gigs or anything. I mean, it was more like a recreational when I had time off or when after the shows, you know, to unwind a little bit. By the time you're in your mid-30s, you're wearing it. You know, you don't look as good. You don't recover from colds as well. I put on some weight. I had to stop running because my knees were making noises. The next thing I knew, I'm going, man, I'm going to be one of these chunky blues women that is going to be 60 years old, and people are going to say, man, she's really been through it. And but, you know, I wanted to work with Prince, who called me up and said, come to Minnesota, and we were going to do maybe something like a duet on a video. And I looked in the mirror and went, oh, my, this is not going to work. So it was an inspiration to just lose weight, and I just loved, I got the sobriety thing and realized a lot more about my personality quirks and the things that were making my life get in my own way. And so I've been sober about 35 years now, and I suppose I have Prince to thank for it.
Bonnie, let's talk about the song Just Like That, which is the Song of the Year Grammy nomination. Tell me a little bit about its background. Where's it come from?
Well, I was watching the evening news, and often at the end of the news, they put a human interest story to try to, you know, soften the blow of what just went down. And they followed, they were doing a story, they took a film crew to follow a woman going to the home of the man who had received her son's heart, and they were going to meet for the first time. So I was already emotionally primed at that point. And they hugged, and he invited her in, and they followed her in with the camera. And then he asked her to sit down next to him and asked her if she'd like to put her head on his chest and listen to his heart. And I just, I'm teared up now because it was so incredibly moving to me. And it stayed with me and stayed with me for, you know, a couple of weeks. And I decided that I really wanted to write a song from that point of view. So that's where the germ started of that, because I just made up a story. I'm a big short story fan, and I was trying to figure out how I could put in some elements of what a woman who was felt responsible by looking away for a second while she was driving and was in an accident and her son was killed, And you know, I just made up a backstory on that she was living in just in darkness and drinking and probably suicidal, thinking she was responsible, and had no idea that this man was looking for her for 20 years or so, and knocked on her door, and she let him in. And that turned out he had her son's heart. I just was playing on my couch one day, and I started, opened up the lyrics, and the song just fit. It came out in one big rush.
I watched him circle around the block, finally stopped at mine. Took a while before he knocked, like all he had was time. Excuse me, ma'am, maybe you can help. The directions weren't so clear. I'm looking for Olivia Zan. They said I might find her here.
Bonnie Raitt, I couldn't be more grateful to you for your music and for your being here with us today. Thank you so much.
David, I'm such a fan. Thank you for including me in your pantheon of interviews.
Bonnie, thank you. Be well.
Thank you so much. You too, David.
Bonnie Raitt's latest album is entitled Just Like That. She's up for 4 Grammy Awards this year, including Song of the Year and Best Americana Album. The ceremony is February 5th. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Staff writer Kella Fasane covers a lot of subjects for us. He writes about politics and sports and music, a lot of music. Recently, he met up with a legendary figure in hip-hop, the frontman and MC of Public Enemy, Chuck D.
So I met Chuck D for the first time at this bar called the Ivy Lounge in Manhattan. It was empty. It was during the day. They had cleared it out for us. And you know, I think I was expecting a slightly more stern person than the guy who walked in.
Hi, how you doing? I'm Kay.
Hey, Kay, how you doing?
Good to see you
again. Absolutely. I've seen you somewhere.
You see me? Yeah, maybe, yeah. I'm so excited to sit down with you. I hope you do.
Like a lot of people, I saw the Fight the Power video from 1989, directed by Spike Lee. You know, Chuck D and Flavor Flav and the other members of Public Enemy leading a march through Brooklyn. So Chuck D was 26 when the first Public Enemy album comes out. And almost from the beginning, he seemed like an elder statesman. He seemed like a big brother. And he has this new documentary called Fight the Power, How Hip-Hop Changed the World. You know, it's all about the connections between hip-hop and the world around it, the culture around it, the politics around it.
The ingenuity of DJ Kool Herc was the spark that ignited this beautiful art form called hip-hop.
When I listen to Public Enemy now, I hear it as protest music in a double sense. I hear it as protest music against, you know, the state of the world, but also that there's an internal protest, a sense that Public Enemy is protesting what's going on with hip-hop. But one thing that I noticed when I watched the documentary, and even more when I talked to him, he seemed to be more focused on potential. What he mainly sees is the hope of all the things that hip-hop might yet still become. Do you remember when you first got a sense in New York City that something's happening, something new is happening, these kids are doing some sort of new music, this thing called hip-hop is bubbling?
Yeah, of course, the technical aspect. I thought, like, why do they need two turntables in case one breaks down? But when I heard it, it's like, okay, you got mixers. What the hell's a mixer? I know what a cake mixer is. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So I, like anybody else, was naive. And this person that's on the microphones is doing a little bit like the presenters do on AM radios, playing black music, WBLS on the FM dial. Before that, WWRL played all the black music in the city, mm-hmm. And the surrounding metropolitan area. And it was a small 1600 bandwidth station at the end of the dial. And they'd be like, Gary Bird, 1600 on the WWRL dial. Come on, this is LTD. And you'd be like, wow, man. You know what I'm saying?
From WWRL New York, Progressive AM in the Apple. And I'm Gary Bird from the GB Experience.
Gary Bird was a person that I grew up with twice, growing up with him playing music on WWRL. Later on, Gary Bird hooks up with Stevie Wonder. They end up being friends. Stevie Wonder produces a song for Gary Bird called The Crown, where Gary Bird is actually like a 16-minute dropping bars about our brilliance as human beings and as black folk. Well, Stevie Wonder does that, and it's a Motown rap record in 1982. Never gets talked about. So we'll talk about it right here.
People of the world, wherever you be, welcome to Cosmic University, where life is the journey and love is the trip, and the study of them will make you hear. I'm professor of the rap, and when I speak, I guarantee that my lines will not be weak. They say a mind is a terrible thing to waste. That's why I'm here and on the case.
At that particular time, you know, hip-hop was emulating all this with the great voices, playing great music, going from the ones and twos, being able to, you know, bring that noise to the people. So I came up in all that.
It's a four-part hip-hop documentary on PBS, Fight the Power, How Hip-Hop Changed the World. Why is that important for you, for that to be your focus? How hip-hop changed the world?
Most important word in that is world. I've been to 116 countries over 38 years, so I see the changes. And have people come to me with different languages, although I can't interpret not one other than the King's English, unfortunately, which is my biggest regret. But people have made their way to say, Chuck, this is what this art form has meant to me in all continents except for Antarctica and parts of the Arctic.
There's a quote from you in the documentary. You say, the pioneers in the beginning, they could have easily rapped about the real things that's right in front of them. Guns, drugs infiltrating New York City in 78, 79. And they said, you know what? It's no way that's going to be popular. We want to keep the party going.
Yeah. Not that they wanted to commodify it into something that's going to just quickly, just like, it's got to be popular so I could get money. Yeah, they wanted to make money to get up out of there.
Right.
But I think it was one of those things. It's like, okay, everybody knows them damn stories. What's our escape route? We want to have escapism. We want to take this spaceship up out of here. Beam me up, Scotty, fast.
Did you feel like you wanted to join this hip-hop movement that was happening? Or did you feel like you wanted to redirect this hip-hop movement that
was happening? To curate, present, navigate, teach, and lead the hip-hop art as making it something that people will revere, just like Grant Wood. You know what I'm saying? So I was educated in the arts ever since I was a little kid. My mother started Roosevelt Community Theater in 1973 in Roosevelt. I was under Frank Frazier's tutelage as an art teacher in 1972 in Roosevelt. I go to Adelphi University to become a commercial artist. But as what? I had no idea. I definitely wasn't going to go into architecture. And I wanted to become a renderer. And the music led me to the point, even if I got kicked out my first year at the freshman year at Adelphi, I actually got back in because all of a sudden Hip Hop Records came out and I said, wow, I could be in the music business as a hip hop illustrator, art department, album jackets, advertising. Wow, okay. And that got me through the rest of Adelphi where I graduated Dean's List in 1984. So hip hop as an idea got me through college.
I think a lot of people nowadays might not realize just how radical Public Enemy was when you came out.
Why would I count them if they don't realize it? It's like,
but I don't just mean radical compared to America. I mean radical compared to what else was happening in hip hop at that moment.
You have to take a long survey of what was happening in hip hop to make a comparison.
Right.
It's not an art form that could be really easily thrown to you in 4-part series and you get it all. So if we were able to repeat the context of Public Enemy, how could you talk about being in the middle of a decade where communities are destroyed by R&B? It's Reagan and Bush, COINTELPRO, crack and guns, you know what I'm saying? Drugs and guns. At that time, when we started out, Nelson Mandela was in prison in South Africa. Margaret Thatcher was running the UK. And Gorbachev's Soviet Union was teetering on the brink of disaster politically, worldwide, and this was trickling down to like, damn, can we actually be humans too? Public Enemy was kind of like, okay, I'm making records. I am the voice of in the middle of this, but at the same time, I'm bringing a community with me. And that was my role, to actually lead a whole community, even a community that's juxtaposed and not getting along with each other.
Right.
You know, being able to be that voice of maybe some reason.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it. It said they were suckers. They wanted me for their army or whatever. Picture me giving a damn. I said never. Here's a land that never gave a damn.
See, number one, rap was able to use more words.
Yeah.
In a shorter distance of time.
Yeah.
Singing, I mean, I'm bad on lyrics. I still don't know what the hell a lot of songs are saying.
Right.
I can't make out the lyrics. And nobody seemed to ever say that, yeah, well, you know, everything else in popular music is unintelligible because they happen to sing their words instead of speak their words. Well, hip-hop and rap happens to damn near speak their words.
Yeah. And there's like a justification thing that happens in hip-hop where there's this sense of, who are you? Who are you to be talking to me? And so rappers would say, this is who I am. Let me tell you who I am.
It's the first rejection of the slave name. You know, it's like, you know, I can't call myself Malcolm X, but you know what? I'm Chuck D, that type of thing. You know what I'm saying? I'm KRS-One, you know, I'm not Chris Parker.
Right.
And the rejection of the slave name was really the socio-political thing that white folks in America, when you tell them that, they're like, I didn't even know that. I didn't even think of it that way. Well, number one, you didn't have to. But if you want to understand the page of where we're coming from, being called somebody else is number one on our brains of something that we're trying to change. And when I call myself something else, you find difficulty in it.
In 1997, in your book, you wrote, right now, rap is being used in a way that's negative to the existence of black people.
Yeah.
Why did you feel that way?
because the curators were failing and it was dropping the ball, explaining what it could do and actually put things in the right context and place. Hmm. I'm 37 at the time, and I saw people saying, well, we could grab the lowest hanging fruit and just to get the eyeballs in order for me to make a living with it. I'm like, damn, all right? Hmm. So me, I have a firm belief is like, spectacle gets you interested and gets you in the building. It don't keep you there. Hmm. Spectacular keeps you there. Matter of fact, spectacular keeps you coming back for more. Hmm. The rock guys understand that. I was with Prophets of Rage 4 years. Every night we got a standing ovation and rocked hard as hell. I'm not saying it never happened in the rap world. It's just that it's been groomed differently. Hmm. You know, I mean, in the rock world, man, people come back and back and back and back. The promoters take it seriously. Hmm. The black thing, the promoters always felt, yeah, if we could get a lot of money for it, we don't know how long it's going to last. And we'll take this headache money, and if it burns out, burns out. It's disposable, cool, we'll get the next one to replace it. I think that's been a disservice to the art form. And I said that at 37 years old in 1997, and clearly we've seen.
But it's also, if you go back and when I think about the mid to late 90s, I think of that as another golden age for hip hop. I think of that as the
golden corporate age.
But I think of that as the Jay-Z era, the Missy Elliott era, the Outkast era.
Well, with the exception of Outkast, you're giving me a whole bunch of individuals. Mm-hmm. Around the turn of the 90s, the record companies and corporations felt they could reduce the culture's elements down to one, which mm-hmm. is the emceeing mm-hmm. on a record. Mm-hmm. So you remove the other elements, DJ, and that was removed. The dance element was removed. Art element was removed. You got MCing. Okay, they're making records. The biggest change is when they seen that the downsizing from collectives into solo acts is what probably was the biggest change. And because that wasn't handled or managed correctly, mm-hmm. hip hop became a whole bunch of soloists in the 90s, because it was easier to renegotiate with one person than a group. Therefore, if you name your best groups out of 2000, you name it individuals. You name your best groups out of the 80s, you name it groups.
Right.
Destroy a collective.
But part of that, I think, is because rapping is so powerful. I mean, when I think about Public Enemy, there's so much going on. But I think about you and your voice and Flavor Flav's voice and these incredible tracks.
So, you sitting home and thinking, but if you saw us performing, which is performance is always the extension of art anyway, you ain't just seeing me standing on a mic and fucking spitting bars. So I think this documentary raises the bar over the bars. Hip hop is all the panoramic elements and motion. You know, you got sight, style, sound, and story. Those things, when they circulate, that's what you have, something that people say, I'll come back to for years and years. One MC spin bars over beats, man, it's like, that's when it comes down to a point where anybody could do it. You got it right in the studio, you practice that. You know, the studio's gonna make it right before it leaves, and they go out to perform it. And I'm like, well, they gotta go through a rites of passage just because they're a star without proving it. And the first thing I look for is they're going to run out of breath. They're not going to be able to do what they recorded. Number three, all right, they're on a tour. They're going to lose their voice after the first 3 days because they're trying too hard. And then you'd be like, ah. In the rock world, you rehearse, and your first night, you better get it right, and you better not have any mishaps on the whole thing.
To go back to the question that's kind of implied in the documentary about how hip-hop changed the world, how did hip-hop change the world? And did it change the world for the better?
Well, for the last 30 years, hip-hop's been in Africa, and they've surpassed the natural skill set that we're accustomed to in the United States of America, but that's always the case. If you pay attention to Africa, you know, the whole key is to make yourself feel better or superior. It's like, all you gotta do is pay Africa no mind, like it don't exist. Like, you know what? It might have started over there, but we're not acknowledging it until it starts in the United States. And that's just, that's derogatory to the black diaspora. You cannot separate the black diaspora from black creativity in the future. So I've seen hip hop changed the world many times over in places that's not just reduced to people under the construct of dark skin. I mean, in Yugoslavia, and ourselves and Ice-T saw a war stopped as we're doing a concert there in an ice arena. And they stopped the war for one day in a Yugoslavian, you know, conflict between Croatia and Serbia and Montenegro and Slovenia. Next day, they tell Public Enemy and Ice-T, all right, it's time for y'all to raise up out of here because we're going to war tomorrow. Sure enough, we left over the borderline, boom, bombing over there. Wow. So hip-hop has changed the world because they would look at Fight the Power and 6 in the morning as far as anti-authoritative, you know, conversation and applied it to their life, their language, their whole situation. Said, yeah, we got another guide map based on black people in the United States music and vibe to actually apply to ourselves and our movement.
But isn't it interesting how things have flipped? How hip-hop used to be so divisive and polarizing. Some people loved it, some people hated it. Radio stations would say, we play all the hits and no rap. And now here we are, and you're talking about the divisions in America, and sometimes it seems like hip-hop is one of the only things that just about everyone seems to like.
It's like evolution. How can you not study evolution? I mean, it's like revolution starts out. Evolution, what it evolves into, mm-hmm. You know? I mean, Curtis Blow is revolutionary. Mm-hmm. Jay-Z is evolution. He's an evolution, the culmination of all these things that led up to him doing the great things that he does.
Yeah.
Will it be evolution after Jay-Z? Sure there will be. Is this thing going to be called hip-hop? Or does it get termed into something else? Probably. You know, we had jazz before everything was jazz.
Right. And that's what we expect, is that things are going to change and mm-hmm. the era's not going to last forever. Mm-hmm. So how has the hip-hop era managed to last for half a century?
50 years is not long in real life. 50 years long in cultural life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very long.
But in real life, it's like, yeah.
But do you think 50 years from now, two people might be sitting in a rooftop bar in a hotel talking about how did hip-hop manage to last 100 years?
Shit, you better be hope 50 years from now people will be sitting. I mean, really, let's go 10 years at a time.
Okay.
I'd like to take 10 more years of people understanding that they got to take care of the next generations, teach them, take care of the planet. Mm. And I think hip-hop will always gonna be there. It's going to ride regardless. I don't think hip-hop's the thing that you ask to be around. We want to ask for human beings to be around. We want to ask for the way of life, peace, love, sharing to be around.
Fight the power!
Chuck D of Public Enemy. He's a creator, along with his producing partner, Lori Bulla, of Fight the Power, How Hip-Hop Changed the World. It's a documentary series now on PBS. And you can find Kelafasane's writing on hip-hop and a wide range of other musical subjects and more at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The list of movies and TV shows adapted from video games is really long and it's kind of checkered. For every Tomb Raider, we have dozens of forgettable shows and would-be blockbusters that just weren't. But now there's The Last of Us, the HBO show based on a series of games set in a post-apocalyptic world. The Last of Us has been years in the making, and it's turned out to be a huge success, both critically and commercially.
I know what's out there. We were going with an entire squadron for that very reason. But now I don't have a truck, I don't have a squadron, Fedra's 5 minutes away. What I do have is you. And I know what you're both capable of, for better or worse.
I talked to Alex Barish, who's an editor at The New Yorker, to understand why adapting video games has been so difficult over the years and what makes it work when it does work. Alex wrote about The Last of Us in December. Alex, I think you know me well enough to know, after all this time spent working together, that what I know about video games you could fit in a thimble. My kids will never forgive me. They're grown now, but I outlawed them at home. They remind me of this all the time, and maybe I made a mistake. But you love them, and more to the point, you're telling us that video games are now kind of, it's a long process, but have been influencing all other kinds of arts, particularly, obviously, television and movies. So what I'd love for you to do for us today is give us three instances where video games have been adapted to great effect and real effect on popular culture. So let's go to it.
I think we do have to begin with Super Mario Brothers, which I would not call a great adaptation, but it is an instructive one in its impact and its reception. Nobody in Hollywood had tried the live-action feature-length, you know, video game adaptation as a form. And frankly, the game did not give them a lot to work with in the way of plot.
They're brothers. They're plumbers. They're on the trail of a kidnapped princess and a mystical meteorite.
It's incredible!
That gives anyone who possesses it the power to rule the universe.
So when they came to adapt it, there was a degree of self-consciousness, a kind of desire to say, this is something more than the game. The tagline, in fact, was, this ain't no game. And they were aiming for a kind of Ghostbusters-y, subversive comedy mode, slightly darker, slightly zanier, and they missed.
But unless I'm wrong, Super Mario Brothers was a console game. It comes out in 1993 as a film, and lo and behold, in 2023... somebody's taking another crack at it.
Oh, yes. We are trying again with Chris Pratt in the title role.
It's me, Mario.
And I think this speaks to Hollywood's quest. You know, they've not given up. It was a box office bomb at the time, but nobody has given up on cracking this formula.
Now, we come next to something that dominated my household when my kids were really young. Pokemon.
This is the one that is nearest and dearest to my heart, I will say, in terms of the adaptations past. And it had this really interesting, sort of unusual mutualistic relationship between the games and the series. The series, I should say, had 1,200 episodes, 25 seasons. It's still going strong. And every time a new game came out, they would take the protagonist of the show, who is this sort of perennial 10-year-old called Ash Ketchum, and plop him into the new region. So he meets all the same monsters as you meet in the game. He's meeting the same characters. He's fighting the fights that you as a player would undertake. And that sort of feedback loop has continued for decades now. It was actually recently announced that Ash would be stepping down as the protagonist after some 25 years. So there was a real outpouring of nostalgia and excitement about that. And
is Ash retiring to Boca Raton?
We can only hope after the service that he's put in.
You did it, buddy!
Now, not long ago, you came into an editorial meeting, I don't know, a few months ago, and said that HBO was going to make a huge hit show out of a game called The Last of Us. Am I right?
Yes.
And I greeted this idea with a raised eyebrow, but said, Alex, you go ahead and do it.
The video game turned small screen sensation had HBO's second biggest debut
of the last 13 years behind only House of the Dragon.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. The premise of the show and of the game is quite simple. A fungus-based pandemic has decimated society, and there's a smuggler called Joel, who is played in the show by Pedro Pascal, who lost his daughter at the beginning of the outbreak some 20 years prior. And he is thrown together with this young girl called Ellie, who, it's understood, may be immune to the pathogen and thus could sort of save what remains of society. So they have this kind of road trip across America. He is taking her to a lab where they hope that they will be able to engineer a cure.
Joel, I can handle myself.
It's called luck, and it is gonna run out.
You hear that? Run! There's too many of them!
That sounds like every post-apocalyptic story under the sun, but it's really about sort of the ways of living that people have carved out for themselves in this landscape. You know, there are some people who are building these kind of idealistic socialist communes. There are people who've barricaded themselves into their own towns and won't let anyone else in. There are people who've turned to incredible violence. There are, you know, all of these different modes of existence. And you're sort of seeing all of this unfold through the deepening relationship, this kind of father-daughter dynamic between the two of them.
So, Alex, Super Mario Brothers, Pokemon, and The Last of Us, is this all about Hollywood's search for intellectual property that will become the next Marvel or something like it, a franchise that will just float the boat financially?
I mean, I think that's certainly a factor. You know, Amazon, Paramount, Netflix, basically every studio and streamer under the sun is trying to do some version of this. And there have been a lot of false starts. You know, Assassin's Creed with Michael Fassbender and Marion Cotillard was sort of believed to be the next great hope of video game adaptations back in 2016, I think it was. And that just crashed and burned, and plans for sequels were promptly scrapped. So, you know, there has been some attempt over the decades to get something like this off the ground. But I think that The Last of Us has the advantage of this inherently cinematic quality and of a team that genuinely believes in what they're doing. So it's not this kind of cynical cash grab alone, you know.
Is it possible to predict what other games will become the television and movies of the near future?
I mean, there are a million that are currently in development. You know, Amazon just announced a God of War series. Netflix are trying about a dozen different things right now and seeing what sticks. I mean, I think the thing to look for, and I hope that they know this now, is, you know, strongly defined characters and a strong narrative backbone, something that a lot of these adaptations have historically lacked because, you know, when you're playing a game, you want to be able to project onto the character. You kind of get to fill in the gaps or even customize the way that they look and the way they act. And when that comes to television and they're just an empty cipher, it's not very interesting to watch because you have no reason to care about them. So I think if people are careful in their selection of source material, then they will have much more success in that arena.
Alex, thanks so much. Great to talk to you as always.
Yeah, thank you.
Alex Barish is an editor at The New Yorker, and you can find his reporting piece about The Last of Us at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with the New Yorker Radio Hour next week, and we hope you'll join us.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of TuneYards. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Brita Green, Adam Howard, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, Louis Mitchell, and Ngofen Imputabuele, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Harrison Keithline, Mike Kutchman, and Meher Bhatia. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.